Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Was a monstrous killer brought to justice or an innocent mother condemned? On an April night in 1989, Joanne Parks survived a house fire that claimed the lives of her three small children. Though the fire at first seemed a tragic accident, investigators soon reported finding evidence proving that Parks had sabotaged wiring, set several fires herself, and even barricaded her four-year-old son inside a closet to prevent his escape. Though she insisted she did nothing wrong, Joanne Parks received a life sentence without parole based on the power of forensic fire science that convincingly proved her guilt. But more than a quarter century later, a revolution in the science of fire has exposed many of the incontrovertible truths of 1989 as guesswork in disguise. The California Innocence Project is challenging Parks' conviction and the so-called science behind it, claiming that false assumptions and outright bias convicted an innocent mother of a crime that never actually happened. If Parks is exonerated, she could well be the patient zero in an epidemic of overturned guilty verdicts, but only if she wins. Can prosecutors dredge up enough evidence and roadblocks to make sure Joanne Parks dies in prison? No matter how her last-ditch effort for freedom turns out, the scenes of betrayal, ruin, and hope will leave readers longing for justice we can trust. The book that we're featuring this evening is Burned, A Story of Murder and the Crime That Wasn't, with my special guest journalist and author, Edward Humes. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Edward Humes.
Good evening, Dan. Yeah, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's talk about how you came to be the author, how you came to this story, and why you wanted to write Burned.
Well, there's a lot of reasons for that. I shouldn't laugh. It's very, but I started out wanting to learn about the California Innocence Project, which is one of many such initiatives around the country where they basically exist to search out and take on cases in which they believe someone was wrongly convicted. And we've all read about exonerations and heard of the Innocence Project, but I didn't really know much about how they operated, how they found their cases to take apart an investigation, to be sort of reverse detectives and look at a crime and unravel what the authorities put together and make a determination whether or not justice was or was not done. I'm fascinated by that, and I think most people would be interested. And while making that inquiry and spending time immersing in that world, I learned about the Parks case, and it seemed like a good choice to use her story, Joanne Parks' story and experience, as a way of digging into talking about larger issues of justice and injustice. And as I soon learned in examining what happened with Parks into the world of forensic science, and learning that oftentimes, depending on the forensic discipline, there's not a whole lot of science in there, and that's a problem.
Certainly. Let's talk about the case of Joanne Parks and Ronnie Parks Sr. and their three children, April 9th, 1989, in a suburb of Los Angeles called Bell. Just tell us before the circumstances that they were, you say that they were just there recently, they had just moved to this apartment. So just give us a little bit of the background of the family itself and where they were on April 9th, 1989, before we get into the evening just after midnight and what happens and the involvement of the next door neighbors, the Shirley and Bob Robison. Take us back a little bit just before or April 9th, 1989.
Sure. Well, Bell is a small municipal island inside the larger metropolis of Los Angeles, and it's not a particularly prosperous place. And the Parks weren't a particularly prosperous family. Both parents worked. Ronald Parks' dairy plant on an overnight shift. So at the time of the fire, he had left for work several hours before. And his wife, Joanne, was considerably younger than him. They had married when she was 17. He was in his mid-30s. She had lied about her age in order to get past the need of having parental permission for the marriage. And it was a bit of a whirlwind courtship for which neither was prepared for life afterwards, because they quickly had one child and then a second and a third. Joanne Parks worked part-time as a waitress, but she was not working at the day of the fire. Now, this is her account to the police of what happened inside their 528-square-foot apartment, which was a converted two-car garage in back of a main house in Bell. And they had somehow squeezed three bedrooms into this tiny garage apartment. And Joanne Parks told the police she had put the children to bed. They were still in the process of unpacking. The place was still filled with boxes and things that hadn't been put away from their recent move into this apartment. To bed an hour and a half or 2 hours after the children, and awoke just past midnight to the sound of one of her children screaming. Her son, there was one boy, 4 years old, and one and two-year-old daughters. And she said that, later told police that awakened her, and she opened the door from her master bedroom into the main part of the house and was greeted by a wall of flame and heat so intense that she could not even move forward a step. Not knowing what to do, she, other than to try and get help, again, this is her account to police, there is no other witness to this, she ran to the house in front and banged on the door, and that was where the Robesons lived, and they both raced out to see what they could do to help. At that time, dialed 911 to summon the police and fire department.
What was Shirley Robeson's and Bob Robeson's statements to police? What was their experience with Joanne Parks? According to them, what did Joanne Parks say to Shirley, immediately coming to their home and banging on their door?
She banged on the door and was screaming that her children were inside and the police help. They're still in there, my babies. And they didn't need her to tell them that there was a fire going on, because they could see the glow of the flames when they opened the door and came out. And the garage was situated in back of their house with a driveway leading out to the street. And so they went to the driveway and saw what was happening. And the door, there was two doors into the house. There was the front door, and then the door that Joanne exited, which was from the master bedroom that went directly outside. And he saw that door was open, and he could see the flames inside. Joanne, and again, this is a composite of what Joanne and the Robeson said. They all were pretty much told the same story, that while the women went inside and called 911, Bob Robeson raced into the house to see if he could get to the back and reach the children. The flames had become even more intense and spread into the master bedroom very quickly because Joanne Parks had apparently left the door from her bedroom into the interior of the house open as well. She had just turned and ran outside, and that allowed the flames to enter the master bedroom. And Bob Robeson was unable to get out of the master bedroom and into the rest of the house. He was overcome by the smoke and heat, and he described seeing, it looked to him like even the air was catching fire. He saw sparks in the air, and as if the ash was still flaming in the, and he dropped to his knees and kind of scrabbled out back outside, gasping and coughing, and grabbed the garden hose and started trying to water the flames, but it had no effect. Meanwhile, Joanne, according to Shirley Robeson, made a move as if to run back in the house, and Shirley grabbed her and held her from doing it. Said, "No, you can't. You can't go in there." And then she just stood there with Joanne and watched and waited to see what Bob Robeson could do, and kind of kept her arm around her in case he tried to run back into the house, but she made no further attempts to do that.
You talk about other people, like a teen boy named David Haney, 19 years old, happened to be in a tuxedo from a formal social he had just attended, and joined in this, what he thought was to aid these people, trying to aid the people that were involved in this fire. So he ran alongside the building with a hose as well. Tell us about his efforts, and also how long it takes police to get there, and once they get there, what is their reaction? What do they do in their attempt to help with the people in this fire?
Sure. Well, David Haney, tuxedo man, he had lived in the neighborhood all his life, and he had known the previous residents in that very apartment and had visited it, so he knew the place really well. And he had scrabbled over fences and cut through yards when he saw the flames rising in the night, and he was afraid it was the house next door to the Parkses, where an elderly gentleman who was a friend of his lived, and he was so alarmed he went over to see if he could help, and then he saw it was that other house, the Parks' house, and he still wanted to help. So he grabbed another garden hose from next door, from his friend's house, I think, and started spraying it in through the open living room windows, where the windows had already failed, the glass had broken from the heat and flames. Tuxedo Man is a really important witness, and at the preliminary hearing against Parks, years later, he was the very first witness called, and he's important because of he can help establish a timeline for the fire. And he reported that not only was the living room engulfed in flames when he arrived, which was well ahead of the police and fire department, but that some of the back bedroom windows also had flames shooting out of them. So his information helps establish when the house really became fully or mostly involved with fire, and that it was already out of control well before the first responders arrived. And he describes that the scene was just an inferno. He says he couldn't get closer to that open window than 8 or 10 feet with the hose, and it was overwhelmingly hot even at that distance, to the point where he had to turn the hose on himself and wet himself down because his clothes felt like they were about to catch fire. They were already singed. And then as soon as he would soak himself, he'd turn around and face the fire again and start trying to put it out. And the water would boil off of him. The steam was rising from him and quite visibly amid the flames and smoke that were lighting up the night there, and he had to repeatedly keep wetting himself down just to stay close enough to get the water into the living room windows. But that small amount of water that you can get out of the fire hoses, it will have almost no impact on the flames of that severity. His hope was he could knock it down enough so he could scramble in the window and see if he could find the children. And he was one of the several witnesses who heard children screaming inside. And it haunted him for years after that. Some other people also came to help from the neighborhood too. And within just a few minutes, the police and fire department in that order arrived and started trying to get in to make a rescue and to extinguish the fire.
You introduced the character Dirk Wegner from he's a firefighter, L.A. County, and so he ran in there as well because as firefighters, they're much more prepared to be able to run into a burning fire. What was his experience? How far could he get into that home, and what did he see for himself?
Well, he followed several police officers did enter the house, but were unable to get to the children. They had the same experience Bob Robeson did. Another police officer ran around back and broke a window to try and get into the girl's bedroom, and the flames came exploding out of that window, and so he was not able to make a rescue either. Then Dirk Wegner was the first firefighter to enter the house right around the time that back window was being broken, and he was the nozzle man, so he had the hose and was controlling the water flow, and then the other firefighters were behind him, and he came barreling in, spraying the living room and trying to beat down the flames and make his way to the back of the house as directly as he could, past the kitchen and the little kitchen in there, and into one of the bedrooms. And afterwards, one of the fire experts who testified in the case tried to figure out the physics of what happened, and it was an incredibly brave thing for a firefighter to race in like that, because he ran the risk of being surrounded by the flames, and the house was so fully involved with the fire at that point that even his protective gear might not have been enough to protect him fully. Unintended effect of his race to the back was, this one expert theorized, was to literally push the heat and the flames and the smoke back towards the children's bedroom and intensify the flames in there. Whether or not the children were still alive at that point, no one knows, but in all probability, they had died of smoke inhalation well before the firefighters could reach them. That's the consensus opinion of the people who have looked at the evidence in the scene. But Wegner succeeded in making it into the girl's bedroom and knocked down the flames in there. And he was the first one to see that the two girls had been killed in their beds in the bedroom, that they had either died of smoke inhalation or had died from the heat and flames. Mm-hmm. And his oxygen ran out, and he had to leave before he could get to the other child's bedroom.
Right. At the same time, Shirley Robeson is comforting Joanne Parks, is with her, and now police want to get a statement from Joanne Parks at the station. You talk about some officers not knowing the state of affairs, other officers knowing the state of affairs. That considered, what was she told? What was Joanne Parks told as they were taking her away from the scene and to the police station as Shirley Robeson accompanied her to? What did they tell Joanne Parks about her children?
Well, she had been standing at there watching and waiting and kept asking, you know, what about my baby's children? And several officers either said they don't know or that they were going to be fine, that they provided some reassurance that the firefighters were there, that they were controlling the fire, and that her children were going to be okay. So, and several of them said, you know, recalled telling her that, even though they didn't really know that, and you know, didn't even believe it, but they felt like they wanted to keep her calm and reassure her and just hope for the best. So she was, she says she was, and she certainly had been told that she was under the impression that her children were going to be okay, that they would be brought to her at the police station and she could go make the statement. And so a police officer drove her and Shirley Robeson with her to the police department, which was literally two blocks away, and took her statement while she waited for word. Now, at that point, the police already knew, and the firefighters already knew, that the two girls had been killed, but they couldn't find the little boy, the four-year-old, Ronnie Jr., and they began a neighborhood search, thinking that he, in his fear, he ran out and got lost or was hiding. Joanne had sort of muttered something under her breath that the Robesons heard, saying, you know, something to the on the order of, I hope Ronnie wasn't playing with matches again, or I hope Ronnie didn't. They weren't quite sure on exactly what she said, but it was something along the lines that maybe Ronnie had accidentally started the fire. And when they asked her about it afterwards, she wouldn't talk about it. And nor did she tell that to the police when she made her statement. But the Robesons told the authorities about that. And so if that was the case, they thought that little Ronnie might be hiding somewhere in the neighborhood. So they began quite an extensive search and recruited neighbors, including Tuxedo Man, to go out and search for him. So that was the status of what the authorities knew at the time they were taking Joanne's formal statement that the two girls were dead. Joanne didn't know that, and that the son was missing.
Not that there should be a natural assumption by investigators or police, or even these fire investigators, but at the time, there seemed to be an assumption that this was accidental rather than an intentional crime, and everyone proceeded accordingly for the first part initially, didn't they?
Yes. There was no formal determination, but the assumption was that it was an accidental fire. Outwardly, Joanne Parks appeared to be a fearful, upset mother. Robeson certainly didn't have any reason to doubt her veracity or the realness of her grief and fear. And the police were responding in such a way that they, in how they questioned her and how they treated her, that they were thinking it was an accidental fire of some kind, not a deliberate one. And indeed, hours later, when a Los Angeles County fire investigator came and looked over the scene, his preliminary informal call was that it was an accidental, possibly electrical fire.
What
so, yes, that was the initial impression everyone had. Later, of course, that would change.
Tell us about the discovery of Ronnie Jr. and then what police or investigators conclude from that, and also the altercation, we'll say, or the encounter between Ronnie Parks Sr. and Joanne at that police station.
Yes. Well, the neighborhood search didn't turn up anything, and when the fire was finally completely extinguished and it was, you know, the hoses were taken away and it was safe to go in and do a quick search of the or rather a more detailed search of the of what was left. They went to the boy's room and looked in his closet. And at first it appeared that there was just debris in there, burned debris, but in digging through it, they, you know, beneath the clothes that had fallen from the hangers and so forth, they found Ronnie inside, covered over with the things that had fallen on top of him during the fire and the firefighting. And he had died of smoke inhalation and possibly burns. He had either hidden in the closet or had been, you know, locked in the closet would later be an important question. But at the time, no conclusions were reached about that. And unfortunately, although by the time that search was done and the county fire investigator was taking pictures, was supposed to capture the scene as it was when he first entered it, he did not take a picture of that closet in what they would later claim was a closed condition. They took a picture of it with the door open, although that would become a hotly debated point. And the lack of definitive evidence on it has left it in controversy, was because the picture, that first picture, shows a door that was open with debris in front of it so that it couldn't be closed. And supposedly that was taken right away. So the natural conclusion from that might be, well, the door was open during the fire. But it was essential for the prosecution's case for it to be closed. And they were able to interpret the evidence in such a way that it made them feel certain the door was closed and barricaded so that the little boy couldn't escape. And that was one of the most highest points of contention in the case from start to finish, and still is.
You talk about Joanne Parks in this first statement, which you say, of course, is the most important statement, and all other statements are compared to that first statement for consistency, for credibility. So when she talks about in her first statement to police, she tells them about another fire that the family experienced. Tell us about that and what police at that time initially thought with that story related to them, what they thought of that.
Yes. Yeah, and that reminds me also of something you asked about. What did Ronald Parks say when he got there? And all that's related, so we can put that together for your listeners. But yeah, that initial statement was not recorded and it wasn't taken down word for word. It was just a written summary that the police officer wrote down after the interview, after the statement. And that also gives you a clue that they weren't really suspicious of her at all at that point. Otherwise, the tape recorders would have been out and a much more formal statement would have been taken. So Joanne told them that the family had experienced a house fire a year before, and obviously in another dwelling in the Los Angeles area, that had destroyed most of their possessions and gutted the small house they were living in and renting at the time, but no one was injured. They weren't home at the time of the fire, and they had some documented electrical problems in that house that the fire department had deemed had been a fire hazard. And the power had been turned off for a while, but Ronald Parks had turned it back on, and the subsequent investigation, the arson investigator who looked at that, fire investigator, excuse me, that looked at the scene afterwards, felt that it had been caused by an overheated air conditioner cord that had been coiled and on the floor, and that some laundry had been placed on top of it, and that allowed it to overheat and melt and start the fire Although the Parks has said that they, because of the electrical problems, they had left the house with the air conditioner off. So, nevertheless, the finding was that it was an accidental electrical fire, and the there was no, you know, there was no suspicion that it had, at that time, that it had been started on purpose. So, and she freely volunteered that they had, they didn't know about that earlier fire, and at the time, you know, on the night of the second fire, the fatal fire, no one really thought that raised any red flags. The kind of the place where the Parks were renting now was basically owned by a person that was referred to in news articles as a slumlord, who had had many complaints against him for failing to maintain his properties in a livable and safe manner. So, you know, there was that such a dwelling would be at risk for fire didn't really surprise anyone at the time. Now, in subsequent statements, Joanne didn't tell a totally consistent story, and does not look good when you try and figure out what happened. In this case, if an innocent person is supposed to always tell the same story, or so it is said. But an interesting thing happened when Ronald Parks, who was called to the police station from his workplace to come because of the fire and to join his wife there. The first thing he did was walk in and said, you know, why did something to the effect, and Mrs. Robeson was there to hear it. He either said, why did you kill my children, or why did you let my children die? Either way, it sounded terrible that would be the first words he would say as an accusation, or as a, when Joanne Parks was grieving and upset at that point. Of course, so was Mr. Parks, but Joanne reacted very strongly to that and said, I did what I could. I wanted to help them. And she kind of weakly defended herself and burst into tears. But one of the interesting things is that after that, her husband said that when she retold the story, she would say that she had done more than she recalled doing in that first statement, in terms of trying to crawl through the house and making more progress than she had previously said into the house in efforts to save the children. And she sort of made herself, I wouldn't say heroic, but that made it sound like she made a greater effort to save them than she did. And this was seized upon later as evidence of her guilty state of mind, that she, you know, she was lying, because there's no way she could have gone in that house during that fire and not emerged either burned or smelling of smoke, and neither was the case. Ultimately, at the trial, her own lawyer said no, she felt guilty about not doing more, and so told people that she was more heroic than she actually was, out of guilt and shame, not because she was guilty of starting the fire, but felt guilty that she had saved her children. So it's an alternate explanation for why someone might not be consistent in telling a traumatic story like that. But that, again, was another point of contention when she was brought to trial for murder.
Before we get to that, let's talk about the few days right after the story broke in the media, and the outpouring of support for the Parks family by the neighbors and co-workers, local charities, firefighters, strangers, and just the positive stories on TV news and all the offers of jobs and places to stay and thousands of dollars sent in care of the church that they belong to and their pastor, Paul Garman. And then, in light of what was said, I guess, by Ronnie Parks, then on April 12th, 3 days after the fire and day after the TV broadcast, someone else calls. So first, tell us the first reaction and of people and the public and the media to what has happened before we talk about call from Kathy Dodge.
Yes, well, there, as you said, there was extensive coverage of the fire as a tragedy, as a tragic accident, not as a criminal act. And the in print, radio, and television coverage, the Parkses were interviewed. They shook pictures of the children. Joanne gave a tearful statement about how she missed them and didn't know what they were going to do. Next, and the Mr. Parks was somewhat less sympathetic a character. He made remarks to the effect that he just had to put this behind him and move on, and some people were a little taken aback by that, but the overall reaction was that this poor family needed to be helped. And as often happens when a tragedy is publicized in this way, people opened up their purses and their wallets and sent money care of their Christian Science church that the Parkses belong to. And quite a few thousand dollars came in to help the Parks defray the cost of the burial of their children, to support their living costs, because they were homeless and their possessions and clothing were destroyed. Nothing was salvageable, virtually nothing. And people felt terrible and wanted to help. But one person who heard this broadcast, a woman named Kathy Dodge, who had been a former neighbor at a previous house and friend of Joanne, then had a falling out with them, or falling out with Joanne, called the police and said, "Look, you know, this fire was no accident. This was murder." And she went on to say several very damning things about Joanne Parks, claiming that she never really wanted her kids, that she hated to hear them cry, and so would overdose them with over-the-counter cough medicine at night, so they would just go to sleep and not wake up, not disturb her, and that she also made a very chilling statement to Kathy Dodge. She claimed that Joanne once said of that earlier fire, in which no one was hurt, that if only the baby had been home at the time, they would be millionaires now, implying that they would have sued or something or gotten some kind of settlement. But that, unfortunately, this is what Kathy Dodge remembered Joanne saying, if only Ronald, her husband, had come home 5 minutes later, we'd be millionaires, because it would have been too late. Words to that effect. So the police go out and interview her further and get more information and are just horrified that what they thought was an accident and a tragedy might be something far more monstrous and nefarious. And so they brought in a new arson investigator from the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, who came almost a week after the fire to survey the scene. And he and his partner were briefed on these horrendous allegations, and then they went and looked at the fire scene. And unlike the predecessor in there, who suspected it was an accidental fire, they immediately felt it looked highly suspicious and soon were finding indicators to them that spelled arson.
What were those indicators in their minds? What were those indicators that they thought were a clear indication that she had intentionally started this fire?
They found, first of all, a converted garage, and the electrical system, there was not a lot of places to plug things in, so they used extension cords to plug in a lot of appliances, and they found one extension cord in the living room that had provided power to the various appliances in the living room, and it appeared to the investigators that that cord had been tampered with and arranged so that it would start a fire, and they thought that was the launch point of the fire in the living room, and they then looked in the girl's bedroom and felt that there was a spot in there where a second fire had been started. Now, multiple fires are generally considered suspicious, multiple starting points, because if, you know, an accidental fire usually starts in just one place, and arsonists like to start the blaze in several different spots. There was no electrical cords or anything in that second spot. They just thought somebody must have set fire to newspapers or some kind of debris, something that would burn easily, and so a second fire spread from there. And then finally, and it took them a few days to come to this conclusion, they decided that the little boy had been barricaded in his closet by a clothes hamper so that he couldn't get out. And they felt that the burn patterns they looked at in the carpeting and on the door supported that conclusion. Because one thing that they were confused about was, why didn't one or more of these children escape the fire? Okay, well, the boy was trapped in the closet, they theorized. And then they heard the cough medicine. That explains why the kids wouldn't rise from their beds and try and flee, because their door, the bedroom door, was open. They weren't trapped in there. So they theorized that Joanne had used the cough medicine to make them so out of it that they would or couldn't get up and flee. And that was the theory that initially raised suspicion, although it would be quite a while before they filed formal charges and before Joanne Parks knew that she was even under suspicion. Actually, 2 years would pass before they finally decided to arrest her.
To add interest to this story, complicate this further, Ronnie Parks Sr., of course, has a pretty solid alibi that he's at work. However, tell us about his background that would be somewhat interesting to fire investigators and police.
Yeah, Ronald Parks was a Vietnam veteran, and he had been trained as an electrician and in wiring communication systems across the areas where the troops were operating. So he had extensive knowledge, and he was initially, once they decided something suspicious had happened there, he was the prime suspect. He had the knowledge to create an improvised incendiary device, as they started calling this extension cord, and they always felt that he had something to do with it, but he did have a solid alibi for when the fire started. He had clocked in, and many witnesses saw him at work at that time. So suspicion then focused on Joanne Parks, and whether or not she acted alone or with his assistance. They felt like she had to have been involved because of the timing of the fire and the barricading of the closet, the alleged barricading of the closet. But his odd statements about, and then later when he testified, reiterated them about the kids, how he thought of them as spilt milk. He just couldn't worry about it anymore. You need to get on with your life. And he was saying things like that days after his children had died, and it was disturbing, to say the least. And most people who heard him make remarks like that and suspicious, but there was no evidence that they, unless Joanne accused him of being involved, they had no evidence to go against anyone other than her. And so she became the one and only suspect in this case.
Let's get to the eventual arrest and trial for her. She makes other statements, and that, like you say, they look for inconsistencies and embellishments and any kind of just changes and additions to statements. So she does make further statements to police. Let's talk about the arrest and trial and talk about her defense. What is the theory from the prosecution on what happened and how does Ronnie Parks Sr. get eliminated as a suspect completely and the focus entirely on Joanne Parks?
Well, it's because he had an alibi, because he was definitely at work at the time. So that was the initial reason why they moved the sites from Ronald Parks to Joanne Parks. But during the time between their initial conclusion that it was arson and the filing of charges and the arrest 2 years later, a couple things happened that also answer your question about what the defense was in part. The autopsy and toxicology results of the children show they were not drugged, nor had they been injured in any way. Furthermore, the incendiary device that they had been sure was the origin of the main fire in the living room turned out to not have started the fire. An electrical engineer examined those extension cords and said they were burned by the fire. They didn't start the fire. So the whole theory of how the fire started was incorrect. And that did not lead to a reconsideration of whether the case was arson. The investigators used a process that I had never heard of before I worked on this and learned about principles of fire investigation called negative corpus. It's kind of the opposite of the old Latin corpus delicti, where you produce the body of the evidence. That's the corpus delicti. In this case, they no longer had any actual positive evidence of where the fire started in the living room or how it started. But because they were convinced it was a suspicious fire, they said they had to conclude that Joanne set the fire with a match or a lighter or something like that at the place where the supposedly sabotaged wiring was, and just did it by hand when her device didn't work. And there's no actual evidence to support that, and this is why it's negative corpus. The absence of evidence of any other kind dictates they must conclude it was arson. So fire investigation is the only arson is the only crime I know of where it was accepted practice to say a lack of evidence is evidence of guilt. So it's just unusual. It struck me as unusual, and it's a method, this negative corpus method has been criticized by many in the fire investigation field, and it's frowned upon now, but in 1989 it was common practice and used very often in fire investigations, including this one, to conclude that Joanne Parks must have started this fire because there was no other way to explain it. Of course, expert at the trial of Joanne Parks that said, oh, no, there are other ways to explain it. And he went on to testify about how one possible candidate stood very close to those the place where the prosecution said the fire started, an old television set with a patched cord a model, a type of television that had fire issues in the past, fire safety issues in the past, could easily have been an accidental cause of the fire, and it had not been properly ruled out, and then therefore it was improper to use this principle of negative corpus because there was an alternative explanation. And he testified about that in Joanne's defense. And this expert was a retired Los Angeles fire captain who had been an arson investigator for the city and had testified against arsonists many times, but he was convinced that Joanne was innocent and said as much.
The central figure in this, well, one of the central figures in the story, obviously, is Detective Ablott and his testimony and his analysis. Of course, we talked about what his theories are, but let's talk about the things that he said that later, much later on in the story, we know he shouldn't have been able to say. So let's talk about some of the things he said, but especially those that he came to leaps of logic, we'll say, to make those conclusions, and very effectively at trial.
One of the... You mentioned at during the introduction that there was a revolution in the science of fire that happened over, you know, happened years after the Parks Fire. Our understanding of how fire works and what the remaining evidence can tell us in terms of patterns left by flames and so forth has changed considerably. And one of the keys to that change is a new understanding of a phenomenon called flashover. Flashover is something that happens in a room or a building that becomes completely engulfed in flames. And it's a point in a fire where it stops being about an object or objects in a room on fire, and the entire and turns into the entire room being on fire, and every combustible item in it catches fire. That only happens when at high temperatures for a fire that's been burning for a while, and the condition the gases in the house become so superheated that would be the emissions from the burning objects along with the air itself become so superheated that everything bursts into flames. And it's a fatal event if you're in a room where flashover occurs. And it also completely alters your ability to understand what happened in that burning building. And the longer the flashover persists, the less evidence remains to be interpreted afterwards. Flashover can leave false trails that suggest a flammable liquid had been used to start the fire, like gasoline. It can't create the chemical residue, but it can create the appearance in the form of burn patterns of that. It can also mask the actual point of origin, because when flashover occurs, one of the things it requires is a flow of oxygen through a broken window. And the patterns that result from that, they're called ventilation patterns, but they can look like a place where someone deliberately started a fire. So all of these things happen when flashover occurs in a room or in a house that need to be taken into account, and that make any conclusion of arson less certain.
Right.
What happened in the Parks Fire is that Detective Ablott, the lead fire investigator and the main prosecution witness about what caused the fire at Joanne Parks' trial, said flashover did not occur. And by saying that, he basically could say that his ability to interpret the burn patterns that he saw there were not impeded, and he could be certain in his conclusions that there were more than one points of origin, that the closet had been barricaded shut, and that the fire in the living room had been started by hand in the same spot where the supposedly sabotaged electrical wiring was.
He was also He was also able to testify, and I think this is irresponsible, should have been, I think, inadmissible, is that he testified about Joanne Parks, seeming guilty at the crime scene itself. And so he was making a determination, an opinion, again, probably not what he was asked for, but it was allowed at trial in his testimony, and Detective Ablott certainly being the most important, or one of the most important witnesses at that trial.
Yeah, he had an encounter with her after, you know, when he had started the investigation. I guess the Parks just came by the house, and he thought that she acted suspiciously. She wouldn't talk to him, or they just left without any conversation. But he was just one of many witnesses that were found who hadn't said anything at the time of the fire, but 2 years later seemed to recall that she acted suspiciously, although nobody said so at the time, that she either appeared to be not grieving enough, or her crying at the scene seemed theatrical. Again, these are witnesses who weren't even interviewed by the police until 2 years after the fact. Suddenly had all these, and there had been news about the arrest and everything. And suddenly they had all these negative things to say about Joanne Parks. You know, the people who actually were interviewed at the time, like the Robesons, said no such things about it, that they had no thought that she was being insincere. But, you know, over time, then I guess the opinions of others who had read about what a terrible parent she supposedly was from Kathy Doja's statements they sort of joined the bandwagon. And that was a big part of the prosecution's case at trial, that they claimed that her motive was she just didn't want the two kids, that she was tired of them, even though the cough medicine was disproven and the other allegations by Kathy Doja didn't stand up either. Her statement about the first fire made no sense, because, you know, she had said something about if only Ronald had come home 5 minutes later. Well, he had been at the park with the kids the whole time, and Joanne had joined him there. There was nothing about what Kathy Doja said that made any sense. In fact, she was not even called as a witness at the trial. She was deemed to be have no credibility. So the catalyst for the entire case against Joanne Parks, the supposedly main witness, wasn't a witness at all when it came time for the trial. So and yet they still mounted this very personal Joanne Parks' character. And it was very effective with some of the jurors. They said afterwards that they were particularly concerned that she would leave the fire scene without knowing for sure that her kids were okay, that no mother would do that. She wouldn't have followed the police instructions and gone to the police department then if she was really a mother fearing for her children's lives. Several of the jurors reached that conclusion, even though it wasn't articulated that way by the prosecutor when he argued the case. They kind of came up with that on their own, and it certainly helped them decide to accept the prosecution's theory of arson over the defense attorney's argument that it could have been the television, or, you know, we just don't know what happened. There's not enough certainty to conclude that she was, that any crime had been committed at all.
Now, you talk about her conviction, life without parole, and obviously there's subsequent appeals filed. But we have to fast forward this story to Raquel Cohen and the Innocence Project and their involvement. So tell us briefly.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine the despair that Joanne Parks experienced, but you do talk about the kind of isolation she experiences right after, the kind of lack of support that she has right after. Tell us about who's there for her right after, and then how long does it take, and why and how Raquel Cohen and the Innocence Project get involved.
Sure. Oh, I should say one thing, that they sought the death penalty against Joanne.
Right.
And the jury decided on life without possibility of parole. And they said afterwards that it was because they felt like the husband must have been involved, and they didn't think it was fair that he gets off scot-free and she would get sentenced to death. So they felt that they wanted to convict her, that they thought she started the fire, be fair to impose the death penalty. So it was kind of a compromise verdict in the jurors' minds. And that was in 1992. And she went to the women's state prison in Chowchilla, California, which is the largest women's prison in the world. It's where the females on death row are, but it's also where a lot of the lifers like Joanne Parts are lodged. And she's been there ever since. But she did have a champion. Her family had abandoned him, and her and Ronald Parks, who has since passed away, divorced her. And but the fire investigator that had been hired to analyze the fire and then testified at her trial and her defense, Robert Lowe, stayed in touch with her and continued investigating at his own expense of time and effort and money, and produced a lengthy report in what was wrong with the prosecution's case, and kept writing various attorneys, and finally got the Innocence Project interested in looking at the case. And he was really was her champion. And he's a very interesting character. He was kind of ahead of his time in his understanding of fire science, and had a very successful career, first working for the Los Angeles Fire Department, and then for the as a private fire investigator. He has since passed away, but his family, particularly one of his daughters, Mary Ross, who worked for his fire in his fire investigation business, has become a surrogate family almost for Joanne Parks, and has assisted the Innocence Project and agreed to be her Joanne Parks should she ever be released, to give her a place to live and help her get started. The entire Lowe family has been something of a support network for Joanne Parks over the years. Mm-hmm. Now, the Innocence Project decided that they had a case of a wrongful conviction on their hands because of this revolution in fire science. Other arson cases have been overturned, and that this issue of flashover was key, because every expert who has looked at the Parks fire evidence since the trial has said flashover definitely occurred, and that the certainty with which the prosecution testified about the cause of the fire just doesn't hold up, and she deserves to have a second shot, a new trial. And that became the subject of a habeas corpus petition, and which was accepted and litigated just last year, in 2018, in Los Angeles Superior Court.
Now, with this preparation, you talk about Robert Lowe and then the development of this science. And you also, in this book, talk about, and I had mentioned to you in the beginning, that there are recently, the last, I'd say, a year or two, a lot of books talking about the lack of efficacy of forensic evidence procedures, we'll say. And so you go through and examine this and then include fire investigation as well. As you do write in the book, tell us a little bit about the state of forensics and its viability, as you do write in this book.
Yeah, well, you know, most people have an impression of the miraculous side of our forensic sciences from TV shows like CSI, where crimes are routinely solved by the scientific analysis of crime scene evidence. And that is partially true. The problem is that these forensic sciences that we have such faith in, often, depending on the discipline, don't have a lot of science behind them. And fire sciences, fire investigation has been one of them. Others are bite marks that have been used to convict people of crimes, or hair and fiber evidence, or a lot of bullet fragment evidence. All these things where comparisons are being made between what's found at the crime scene and a known sample of something. Very little of that has any kind of scientific rigor behind it. You just have supposed experts come up and testify, oh yes, this bite mark on the murder victim's hand matches this killer's crooked teeth, and I can say with confidence that's the case. And that becomes pivotal evidence. Or, yes, this pattern on the floor I see in the fire shows that this was a deliberately set case of arson and not an accidental fire. And we've seen this over and over in criminal cases, that this pivotal, seemingly scientific evidence is what the juries depend on to rest their verdict of guilty on. And then along came the newest of forensic evidence, DNA comparisons. And this, of all the forensic sciences, this is one that came not out of the world of law enforcement, where people were trying different things to solve a crime and came up with, yes, bite mark comparisons to nail a particular case. And then once it worked, it would be used over and over again. DNA comparisons came out of the medical and scientific research arena long before it was used to try and solve a crime. And unlike the other forensic sciences, it was subject to blind testing and to rigorous peer review and had a ton of science behind it before that first DNA comparison was used to link a killer to a crime. And one of the unintended side effects of this new DNA evidence was it has also been used to exonerate people many times. Thousands of cases have been overturned because DNA evidence showed someone could not have committed the crime. And unfortunately, many of those cases involved other forensic sciences that had been used to positively identify the same suspect. So the irony is our most powerful forensic scientific tool has undermined many other forensic. The National Academy of Sciences did a breakthrough report in 2009 saying, you know, our forensic sciences need to actually have some science in them. We need to research how often is a fingerprint examiner wrong when they say a partial print from a crime scene matches the known print taken from a suspect. How do we know they're right? It sounds like it's ironclad and we all think fingerprints are perfect, but it turns out there are error rates and there are errors. And the more degraded a fingerprint is, the greater the possibility of error is. And that's even more the case with fire pattern identification and with bite mark identification, with trying to match hairs. A lot of that has been revealed to be junk science. And many of the practices that arson investigators used commonly in 1989 at the time of the Parks fire have been discarded because they're wrong. and the fire investigation community has admitted they're wrong. And that innocent people have been charged or denied insurance payoffs or locked away in prison because of bad fire science. And one of the things that has been shown is that failure to be cognizant of flashover and fires has led to erroneous conclusions of arson and wrongful convictions. And that was the root of the case that the Innocence Project mounted to try and free Joanne Parks from prison.
Another part of their argument, Innocence Project too, is that you talked about blind studies, but the importance of this in terms of information going into a fire investigation, where you say what do fire investigators need before analyzing and examining a scene rather than what these investigators had before going examining a scene?
Yes. Well, that's, you're talking about the theory of the idea that in science we blind test things so that
right.
we can have confidence in the results. And a classic example would be a drug trial where one group gets the new drug and another group gets a placebo and nobody knows who has what. Not even the people administering the research test. That way there's no inadvertent sort of tip-offs. And that's called blind testing. And it has a sound scientific purpose. And you can be so that you know there's no outside influence. A forensic examiner will normally have all kinds of extraneous information, as happened in the arson investigation of the Park Zone. Instead of walking in not knowing anything about Joanne Parks and the only thing on your mind is what you see in front of you in the physical evidence, walking in with information about a mother who supposedly hated her children and drug them and had a husband with electrical experience and all this background information that has nothing to do with interpreting the physical evidence at the crime scene is in your head. Now, does that mean that will necessarily invalidate your findings? No, but the same is true of research into a new drug. Blind test doesn't necessarily mean that the results are invalid, but it raises the question, raises the possibility. And the term for this is called cognitive bias. And it's not bias in the sense of having a conscious bias against someone because of their religion or because of their ethnicity or whatever. It's an unconscious bias. It's a normal brain function that's basically a survival mechanism. We see patterns in things and we have expectations and anticipation of what we're going to encounter in a situation, and that influences our perception of the situation. So that if you expect to find evidence of arson, or if you have reason to believe going in that there should be evidence of arson, it may unconsciously lead you to interpret what you're seeing in such a way that it supports those expectations. It's normal to do that. We all do that in ways that are completely innocuous, but real. And that is the term for that is cognitive bias. And so the Innocence Project argued in Parks's habeas corpus hearing that, well, we don't know that cognitive bias influenced the perceptions of the arson investigators, but it's certainly a possibility and needs to be taken into account, and that proper forensics examination would not have given all this extraneous information to the investigators. Then we could have more confidence in their conclusions. In fact, that is something that forensic science community in general is talking about now. What can we do to lower the possibility of cognitive bias influencing these highly subjective comparison we're using in forensics? So it's a much larger question than just the Parks case, and it's kind of like the unacknowledged dirty secret of the justice system that people in the know are really concerned about this issue of cognitive bias influencing everything from eyewitness testimony to forensics, but we're not really acting on it. Just kind of pretending it doesn't happen when in fact it probably happens all the time.
Let's get to this challenge and Raquel Cohen and her experts and what they basically, in a nutshell, try to convince the judge about the scientific revolution in fire investigation and how they painstakingly re-examine this case and try to show the judge the error of Detective Ablott and that investigation and his conclusions tell us about that attempt to do that, and in reaction, what is the prosecution's response? What is it, surprisingly, their reaction, their counter reaction?
Well, the one of the things that has to be proven if you want to get anyone a new trial and to overturn their conviction, you have to prove that their first trial was unfair. And there's a variety of ways you can do that. You know, if for instance, there have been people who have been set free from prison and granted new trials because the prosecution withheld evidence that was favorable to their defense that they were obligated to turn over. So that would mean their trial was unfair and they get to have another shot at a trial. That I just cite that as an example. That's not what happened in this case. In this case, the claim of a unfair trial is based on false evidence being used against Joanne Parks. And one of the main things that they were alleging is it was false to say flashover did not occur. Even at the trial, the prosecution said, admitted, the original prosecutor in the case, said in open court, yes, if flashover had occurred, that would change everything. The Innocence Project thought that they had a really good point on that. And in fact, even the prosecution experts at the latest hearing admitted that, yes, that was false testimony because there was flashover. So everyone was in agreement that their false evidence had been used, that it was important evidence, but was it enough to lead the judge to overturn the verdict? And that became the pivotal argument that the prosecution prevailed on. And ironically, because of the uncertainty in the field of arson rather than the certainty, the judge was unable to decide who to believe. The experts called by the Innocence Project in particular was a fire scientist and investigator named Dr. Greg Gorbett, and he did something no one had done before. He actually mapped the path of the fire and how it spread through every portion of the house, and took into account all the ventilation points, the broken windows, and so forth. And he did a very visual map of the progression of the fire, and he said he concluded that it was really impossible to tell a specific origin point for the fire. That's given the way the fire patterns appeared, and that every window in the house was broken, was shattered, and caused massive amounts of oxygen to flow in and mask the original origin point. You could not say with certainty how the or where the fire started. That the proper finding would be undetermined, which of course would not. You can't prove if you can't prove that a crime occurred, you can't maintain a guilty verdict against Joanne Parks. If it's undetermined, certainly. if science can't reach the conclusion, then you know everybody hates that and they want certainty. But in fact, in this type of fire, there is only uncertainty. That's what this expert said. And you cannot read the fire patterns the way the prosecution wants to say with certainty that the fire was deliberate. It's just not supportable. That's what he said. Science cannot tell us that. It was just literal testimony. But he did make some specific findings. He said that the evidence suggested that the child was not trapped in the closet, that the door was partially open, and that furthermore, that the place they claimed the second fire had been started, again, you could not make that determination with any certainty. The prosecution's experts said they agreed with almost everything Gorbett said, except that they felt like even with all the flashover, they could look at the burn patterns and still say they were suspicious. In order to make that conclusion, they had to create a timeline for the progression of the fire that didn't really match the testimony. Like they for some reason, they just never even acknowledged the testimony of their original star witness, Tuxedo Man. They just pretended he didn't exist, and that the fire had become fierce and started shooting out of windows much later than his testimony indicated. There were several other witnesses like that that they had to either disbelieve, even though they were corroborated, or they had to choose to believe, even though at the original trial they had been discredited in order to support their various positions that this was clearly arson. But that's what they did. And the judge concluded that the fire investigation is such a controversial, unsettled field with so many things still unknown that he felt that it was just a battle of the experts, and he wasn't going to take one side over another and overturn the verdict. So he let it stand. And right now that ruling is being appealed by the Innocence Project.
It's a sad story too. We time to go into it, but you do go into the background of Joanne Parks more so. This is a completely, entirely a sad, very, very sad story. How long has she been in jail, for those people that can't do the quick math? And what is the state of the Lowe family, her surrogate family? What's their viewpoint right now after this result? What's their thoughts?
Well, she's... first part, Joanne Parks has been in prison now longer than, for more than half her life. She was in her early 20s when the fire occurred, and she's now in her mid-50s. So she, for many years, really expected to be in prison and to die in prison. It wasn't, and had stopped hoping for any kind of release, but obviously she did begin to hope once the Innocence Project got involved, so that's regardless of whether you think she belongs in prison or not, because I think if you read Byrne, you can there's multiple conclusions you might reach, but it's that kind of emotional roller coaster. It's just I'm sure it was extremely difficult to basically be conclude that I'm going to be in this institution for the rest of my life, and try and learn a craft or educate myself and have some sort of positive time here, which she has done, and that was, well documented in her trial. But, then to have these crusading lawyers swoop in and say, yeah, we think we've got a good shot at getting you out of here. I can only imagine after you've been through losing your children, being accused and convicted of killing them, and then spending your life in prison and suddenly think maybe there is a way out. If she is innocent, I can't think of a more horrible progression of events than that. She does have this support system, though, not a real family, but a surrogate family. And the investigator Lowe's children and grandchildren all came to her trial, and they correspond with her, they visit her. They've helped Joanne Parks stay anchored to the outside world in some way, and they all believe fervently in her innocence. So, I guess everybody wants to have someone who believes in them, and Joanne Parks does indeed. And they're hopeful. One of the things that the Innocence Project is trying to do is that expert Dr. Gorbett is trying to recreate the conditions in the laboratory of the Parks fire and actually restage it to see whether or not the prosecution's theory of it still being able to make an accurate determination of how the fire started in those conditions is borne out. Or will this experiment show that the prosecution's theory of the case can't be true? So that is the next thing that they're trying to make happen in support of Joanne Parks' case.
Yes, it's a Fascinating book, Edward. Thank you very much for coming on and talking about Byrne, the story of murder and the crime that wasn't. For those that might want to look into other work that you've done, tell us a little bit about Facebook page or website that they might look at and contact you if further interested. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. Well, I do have a website with information on Byrne and all my other books, some of which are true crime, other topics also. It's edwardhumes.com, all one word, so it's easy to find. And there's also an Edward Humes author page on Facebook and Twitter as well, at Edward Humes.
Great. Thank you very much, Edward Humes, for Byrne, A Story of Murder and the Crime That Wasn't. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. Good night.
Thank you, Dan.